York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to talk about the latest in health and healing, a special in-depth investigative report white paper that is posted today on all the different websites. It's a newsmaker. It's all about Gardasil and why the Governor Nikki Haley of South Carolina, who rejected it as mandatory, what part of the story does she still need to get? What do all of us need to know? And why we have a responsibility to share this information today with everyone, including people you know in positions of authority, policymakers, opinion leaders, the media, and legislators. So I'm asking you, when I share this information today, please share it with everyone that you know. Let's get this going out there. The more parents that know about the dangers, the real dangers behind Gardasil, the more they can then be prepared if they choose to vaccinate their children or not. They'll be coming from a more enlightened perspective. So that's coming at you. Also today, my guest in the second part of our program, third part of our program, will be Dr. Barbara Natterson Horowitz. She is a board-certified cardiologist, professor at University of California Medical Center, and in the Division of Cardiology. She's also a trained psychiatrist, and she served in UCLA's Neuropsychiatric Institute. And she specializes in the relationship between psychological states and heart disease. We're going to talk about something that she has come up with. It's rather unique and original. And it's called Zubiquity. Now, what is Zubiquity? Well, that's what animals teach us about health and disease and the science of healing. This is just a one-off. Never heard of this before, so this will be an exciting discussion. Then we're going to talk about what we can do on a lot of important issues to get a handle on it and become informed. I've got a lot to share with you. Let's begin. How often have you been given the respect that you deserve? Well, according to the Association of Psychological Science, respect matters more than money for happiness in life. That's the newest research that suggests that overall happiness in life is more related to how much you are respected and admired by those around you, not to the status that comes from how much money you have stashed in your bank account. That's the latest in the research from the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, and the publication Psychological Science. That's a journal of the Association for Psychological Science. Quote, we got interested in this idea because there's an abundant evidence that higher socioeconomic status, meaning higher income or wealth, higher education, does not boost subjective well-being or happiness much at all. Yet at the same time, many theories suggest that higher status should boost happiness. So if higher socioeconomic status does not equate with a greater sense of well-being, then what does? Anderson and his colleagues hypothesized that higher socioeconomic status, respect and admiration in your face-to-face groups, such as your friendship network, your neighborhood, or your athletic team, might make a difference in your overall happiness. Having high standing in your local ladder leads to receiving more respect and having more influence and being more integrated into the group's social fabric. And this was a many-decade study. So what does this come down to? What's the takeaway message? The takeaway message is that character and honor, principles, ethics, morality, decency, help, compassion, all of those, when they're given to other individuals in our lives, friendships, work, home, that in turn gives us a respect. People respect you, not because you're wealthy, but because you're nice. And nice people do nice things consistently. So respect matters more than money for happiness in life. Now, that's just, I think, just very important. I think it's just common sense. When I look back at all the people in my own life who I really liked and I respected, it was because they were just nice people, not because of what they earned or their achievements. So that's something that kind of equalizes this whole idea that you got to get out, you got to get money, you got to get successful, you got to own a lot of stuff, and therefore you'll be happy and someone will pay attention to you. They might pay attention to you, but for the wrong reasons. On health and nutrition, one more really positive study, especially for those who are overweight, the more of the omega-3 fatty acids you take, and I would suggest between 1,000 to 3,000 milligrams a day in divided doses, 1,000 in the morning, 1,000 in the afternoon, 1,000 in the early evening, the more anti-inflammatory activity is going to go on in your body. And if you're overweight, you have a lot more inflammation. Inflammation can lead to cognitive decline. It can lead to muscle pain, joint pain, diabetes, Alzheimer's. All that is due to inflammation. So the omega-3 fatty acids, either from vegan sources or fish, will help that. And that's good information. So let's make sure we can do that. That's something we can do, and it's not expensive. Now, for the athletes or people that are exercising regularly in this audience, we have a lot of them. Resveratrol comes from red wine. It also, of course, comes from other sources, but grapes mainly. According to the newest study in the Journal of Physiology, when you intake the red wine polyphenol resveratrol, you're boosting your exercise performance by improving strength and endurance. The study was published just this week, and it says high dose, and the high dose is over 100 milligrams. I think it should be 200 milligrams. That's what I'm suggesting people take, and that's how much the people I counsel take, 200 up. You're really going to see a good outcome. Quote, based on these findings, we conclude that resveratrol is an ergogenic aid that improves exercise training via changes in skeletal muscle function and cardiac performance, but also improves energy metabolism, end quote. There are over 1,500 stories on the healing impact of resveratrol. Now, something that combines health with environmental issues, but received no attention, there was an article, a scientific article. It was done by Dean of Harvard School of Public Health, and it looked at hunger around the world. How many people are hungry now? Now, just the most acute groups, meaning those who are literally at starvation levels, they're claiming 495 million women and children under 5, just under 5 years of age, the children under 5, in the developing world. Then the 150 million, or 1 in 4 in Africa, 315 million, or 1 in 7 in Asia, and 30 million, or 1 in 11 in Latin America and the Caribbean. By the way, we have 18 million in the United States children that are food deprived. So you're looking at, this is a big percentage. Now, mind you, that's not everyone who's starving. That's just the women and children. If you took it all together, it's 1 billion. We have a little over 7.3 billion people on the planet. That's 1/7 the entire population is starving. Food, they try to put a nice word on it, you know, food insecure. No, they're starving. Why don't we just call it for what it is? Now, here's where it ties into climate. Quote, on a planet with sufficient food for all, today almost 500 million women and children under 5 in the developing world are undernourished, a consequence of persistently limited nutritious food intake. The number could increase by 20%, reaching 1 in 5 within the next 10 years. It's because as the climate changes, pastoral land that once was able to be harvested is no longer able to be. As a result, they move on. And what is there, they use for fuel, for heating or for warming their homes, so they create desertification. And that means then that land's not coming back. But the people have to go someplace, so there's long migrations of people every day crossing into other areas, other countries, or more often than not, they're not wanted because almost all the countries they're crossing into, those people are hurting as well, and the government just can't continue this. So what is the solution? They've told us the problem, not the solution. One of the solutions is simple. If we stopped worldwide our research and development of biofuels and instead we would grow a sugar beet or a corn or soy that would be used inefficiently, I might add, used, not cost efficient, if we use that land strictly for subsidized food to help people in other countries, at least immediately you get rid of the first problem. And you take that food only through government programs that bypass the official governments, which take 90% of it for themselves and sell it on the black market, generally the rulers or the military. And you set up a system where the only way they get any aid is to make sure that the food gets through. Secondly, go into each of these countries and show them how to put up greenhouses. Greenhouses are the future because greenhouses can negate if it's 130 outside, too hot to grow anything, or if it's cold outside, too cold to grow anything, a greenhouse, you can grow anything. And with the new technologies that exist and the new innovations, including one I've just finished designing. I've designed a new greenhouse specifically for arid areas. I'm starting in the United States, but as soon as I find someone who's able to get me into a country without the corruption, I will not do anything involving corrupt politicians. So forget Nigeria altogether. All right? Someone suggests, oh, they have a connection to Nigeria. Yeah, fine. Someone died and is going to send you a $20 million check if you send them $12,000. No, sorry. I know too many people in Nigeria, including one of my former students who's the leading doctor in Nigeria. No, you got to get into the countryside. You've got to have a mechanism bypassing the corruption, which is endemic in every place in Africa. And it's a tough job because you're not only having to get by all the bureaucracy and all the corruption from India and onward, you got to get to where people actually need it, and you got to give it all to them. So if you're going to put a well in, it's not because 16 cousins show up saying, before you put the well in, you got to give us each money. I've been down this road, all right? And no, the answer is no. So only when you have it absolutely concrete that you can get help to a village without any interference, then that help will come. We'll show them how to do it. We'll put up greenhouses. Within 6 months, you'll be feeding every member of that area from 500 to 2,000 people with all the greens they need. Then you'll be able to grow fruit in there, berries that they would never seen that wouldn't grow in their country. Berries don't do well in hot weather at all, and certainly not sandy weather, sandy soil. And then you show how to reclaim water. There's a system of reclaiming water as it creates and as do all kinds of things you can do. So we have the technology, we have the knowledge, we have the know-how. All we need are people to open some doors. But I'm going to do it in the United States first to show people, film it. Here's what we can do. Then we don't have to have any food insecurity. We don't have to have 1 million people going to face starvation while we're throwing away so much food each day, wasting so much food each day. So we have all the food in the world we need. It's just not in the right places. It's not distributed correctly. It should be and can be. But before that happens, why don't we just show people how to grow food inexpensively, save their seeds, and not be reliant upon foreign aid for food? Make them completely self-sufficient. That's doable. And all it takes is one. Everything in life starts with one. It only took one guy to break the four-minute mile, Bannister, at 3:58. And then 11 people did it shortly thereafter. I'm saying show one village how to become completely self-sufficient, have proper sanitation, water, clean water, grow their own food, save their seeds, do it in an inhospitable area, and then you're not just saving lives, you're creating a sustainable future. So that's the takeaway message from food and food security, and they are right. Boy, we're going to see a lot of riots in the world when people run out of food and try to go to places where they think it is, and those people don't want to share it with them. I'm Gary Noll. We have a lot to talk about today. We're going to go directly into the commentary. This is an original investigative report a white paper. It is now up on my website. I encourage you to download it. It's fully scientifically referenced. Everything I'm going to say, I have orthodox scientific background footnotes. Nothing is said from opinion. 23 footnotes in here. Let us begin. The title of this article from myself and Dr. Nancy Ashley, one of our scholars in residence, is Governor Nikki Haley Rejects Gardasil, A Moment of Sanity in a Sea of Corporate-Sponsored Confusion. Dateline today. Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina, made headlines this week by vetoing a bill initiated by the Democrats which would provide sixth graders with government-sponsored information encouraging parents to get the human papillomavirus vaccine for their children, as well as for one free vaccine for seventh graders. Haley has received a barrage of criticism for her actions and charges of hypocrisy for having previously sponsored a bill in 2007 that would have mandated HPV vaccine in South Carolina, even though she ultimately withdrew her backing because the bill did not contain an opt-out provision, meaning a freedom of choice provision. Now, while the current bill had broad bipartisan support, Governor Haley rejected it as unnecessary because it would be a precursor to vaccine mandate entirely dependent upon government funding. More importantly, however, Haley was quoted as saying her previous support of a human papillomavirus vaccine mandate was a mistake. Now that she has a 14-year-old daughter, she feels differently about, quote, what I am doing and going to do as a parent and what I want my child to experience, end quote. While we support Governor Haley's courage in standing up for a parent's right to determine the health care given to their children, which is laudable, we offer at the same time to Governor Haley, along with every governor in America, every state and federal legislator, every pediatrician, pharmacist, and nurse, a reality check. Mandating or even encouraging or supporting the human papillomavirus vaccine, in our opinion, is tantamount to promoting a public health fraud and intentionally and with malice of afterthought placing millions of young girls and boys' lives at risk for debilitating injury, including death. Our public health policies, including vaccination, have been formed not by independent, qualified scientists, but rather by lobbyists who have paid for access to politicians at the state and federal levels, bringing forth hand-picked, highly compromised scientists and physicians to promote a fallacy and make it codified by law that the human papillomavirus vaccine will prevent cervical cancer and save countless lives, when in fact, independent, honest science shows just the opposite. Therefore, we are offering you an opportunity to review actual scientific evidence that would convince any reasonable and responsible parent, politician, and physician that this vaccine should be banned, not mandated. While the Democrats in South Carolina moan about lost opportunities to save lives and to cut back on health care costs, what they seem clueless and grossly irresponsible about are the facts, once again allowing ideology to trump science. Even Governor Jerry Brown of California demonstrated his unbridled promotion of the Gardasil vaccine by signing into law in October 2011 a bill which gives 12-year-old children the right to choose the HPV vaccine not only without parental approval, but without even parental notification. The scientific facts are that the HPV vaccine is dangerous and even deadly. The major HPV vaccine in question is, of course, Gardasil. That's Merck's premier product that has lifted it out of the financial doldrums since the removal of Vioxx from the market. Do you remember Vioxx, which killed 60,000 Americans, injured over 120,000 with heart attack and stroke? And no one from Merck just went public and apologized for the corruption of that product and the deadly consequences? And these are the people making Gardasil? And you give them a free pass? We spoke with Cindy Bevington at length, who says we should all be very concerned about these repeated attempts to force GARDASIL on our children because there's absolutely no proof that using this vaccine will lead to the prevention of cervical cancer. Bevington, a multi-award-winning investigative journalist, one of America's finest, broke the story in 2007 that Dr. Diane Harper, the lead investigator for the clinical trials of both GARDASIL and its competitor, Cervarix, considered the HPV vaccine to not only be unnecessary, quote, but a huge public health experiment, end quote. Dr. Harper revealed to Bevington that the current rate of cervical cancer in the United States is so low that if every single 12-year-old girl would be vaccinated for the next 60 years to reduce the rate of cervical cancer, it would not be reduced at all. The news was a disappointment to the legislative campaign to mandate GARDASIL across the nation to 12-year-old girls, which was being heavily pushed by Merck together with ALEC and their spokesperson group, Women in Government. Sounds good, right? It is not. A group of hacks put together using their political influence and clout on behalf of manufacturers. Since then, despite all the advertising, GARDASIL is nowhere near as successful as Merck was hoping for. And I consider that very good news. During the push to require GARDASIL for children in Indiana, Bevington went to the hearings and observed Indiana legislators actually weeping, begging for the vaccine to be mandated as they spoke about the lives lost to cervical cancer without it. Why have we become such an anti-scientific nation? We have been misled scientifically into believing that this vaccine will save lives when in fact the opposite is true. The remarkable claims of GARDASIL's benefits by Dr. Gupta and other people who are so misguided, so ignorant, so in disdain of truth, to the benefits of women in the war on cancer are quite simply ridiculous, inaccurate, and fraudulent, and are not supported by any science, even that science funded by Merck itself. We could ask, where's the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, CBC, ABC, NBC, Fox, CNN? Where are the journalists and the resources they have at their disposal to uncover these facts? Is this a truth they do not want to know because they would then be forced to report it? The GARDASIL story is just one example of the bias in official media, both conservative and liberal. Here, then, are 10 facts that would seem that no governor, federal official, or legislator has taken the time to study. If so, we would have a different approach in mandating GARDASIL in the 50 states. 1. Cervical cancer rates are low in the United States. The health crisis is completely fabricated. Cervical cancer in the United States has been at a record lows for the past 20 years. Currently, only an estimated 3,600 women die of cervical cancer each year. The spectacular success in lowering the death rate from cervical cancer can be attributed to the annual Pap screening. Between 1955 and 1992, deaths from cervical cancer declined 74% and continued to decline at 4% per year. Part of the success of the Pap screening lies in the fact that cervical cancer, unlike most other cancers, is very slow growing. It takes an average of 20 years to develop. With screening, there is ample opportunity to catch and successfully treat cervical cancer before it gets out of hand. So a vaccine would not improve upon this already very low rate of cervical cancer death. 2. The human papillomavirus infection is common to all women and does not usually lead to cancer. It is estimated that virtually all women in the United States experience a series of human papillomavirus infections throughout their lifetimes. What the makers of GARDASIL try to hide is the well-documented fact that 90% of all HPV infections go away of their own accord, that is, even without alternative natural therapy, within 2 years, without causing any disease and with no treatment or intervention of any kind. Sorry to tell you this, the makers of this, Merck, but our immune systems are a lot smarter than your scientists for hire. And our immune systems were designed to clear this virus out of our system, and it does it very well. Number 3, Gardasil does not prevent cancer, despite the advertising and all the lies. And all you get are lies, nothing but lies, all the time, every day, every second, from every politician, every bureaucrat, every government officials. They seem incapable of opening their mouth without lying. And yet, instead of discouraging them by challenging them with authentic information and defunding them and deconstructing these mammoth, bloated, corrupt, inefficient, disgustingly vile bureaucracies, we promote and throw more money on them. Bureaucracy upon bureaucracy, all the while taking food out of the mouths of children. Where are our priorities? Gardasil, the clinical trials never evaluated whether or not the vaccine could prevent cancer. Because cervical cancer normally takes 20 to 40 years to develop, it would be too expensive to study a vaccine for that length of time. So instead, Merck scientists decided arbitrarily that the presence of atypical cervical cells was a valid substitute for cancer. They use this hypothesis despite the fact there is no evidence that the types of cervical lesions they chose as their endpoint would eventually lead to cancer. None. Merck has never acknowledged that their entire premise for efficacy of Gardasil rests on pure speculation. And shame on the FDA and you corrupt bastards for allowing this to go through. In fact, many, if not most, atypical cervical lesions, if you had any knowledge of basic biochemistry and physiology, you would know, resolve on their own without intervention. Number 4, Gardasil is not 98% effective at preventing high-grade cervical lesions if you evaluate the scientific evidence. Results of Merck's efficiency or efficacy studies published in 2007 in the New England Journal of Medicine claimed that Gardasil is 98% effective at preventing high-grade cervical lesions. But the article itself reveals that Merck manipulated the data by excluding women and girls who did not follow the exact protocol, when all women in the study were considered, vaccine efficacy dropped to 44%. But even these numbers are only actually reflective of cervical lesions, not human papillomavirus 16 and 18. When Merck looked at Gardasil's ability to prevent all cervical lesions, Gardasil was only 17% effective. And again, their definition of effective rests solely on the unfounded assumption that certain types of cervical lesions turn into cancer. Number 5, pre-existing human papillomavirus infection results in serious cervical lesions after Gardasil, but that doesn't stop them. More damning is Merck's own acknowledgement that in their controlled studies, a percentage of girls actually developed cervical serious lesions following Gardasil vaccine. The vaccine seems to cause the most lesions in girls with pre-existing human papillomavirus 16 and 18 infections, but also in girls who had no existing human papillomavirus infections. At the very least, screening girls for human papillomavirus 16 and 18 infections would give human papillomavirus positive girls the chance to avoid developing cervical lesions by declining the vaccine. Yet not only does Merck not recommend testing for human papillomavirus prior to vaccination with Gardasil, they have actually discouraged this practice, presumably so as not to draw attention to the danger. Anything to maintain the fantasy that this is a safe and effective vaccine. It is neither. Number 6. Gardasil only targets 4 types of human papillomavirus out of at least 150 that have been identified. That's correct. Gardasil is designed to prevent only 4 strains, 16 and 18, which can cause cervical cancer, and 6 and 11, which can cause genital warts. However, there are 150 other types of human papillomaviruses, at least 15 of which can cause cancer, and Gardasil provides no protection against these other strains. Does Merck's so-called consumer education ever mention any of this? Of course not. Why would you have your daughter vaccinated if you knew the protection was so limited? Number 7. Gardasil is only effective for 5 years in girls and even less time in boys. Vaccinating prepubescent children is useless. Despite the sentinel advertising, which suggests that both mothers and daughters can empower themselves through Gardasil, Merck's own studies show that the vaccine is only effective for 5 years. So if your 11-year-old daughter gets the Gardasil vaccine, it would have stopped working by the time she is 16. But since Merck doesn't give out this information voluntarily, these girls and their mothers will be in the dark. The limited studies in males that exist show that the vaccine is gone in 3 years in efficacy, if there is any. Number 8. Gardasil vaccination does not eliminate the need for an annual Pap screening. That is our main defense against cervical cancer. In portraying Gardasil as a treatment that will prevent 90% of cervical cancer, the stronger implication is that vaccinated girls will no longer be at risk of cervical cancer at all. As we have already seen in Finland, this can lead to the false assumption there is no longer a need for annual Pap testing. When women in Finland stopped getting the Pap screen, cervical cancer increased 4 times the incidence in only 5 years. 4 times is 400%. This complacency about risk, started and fostered by Gardasil advertising, is also likely to lead to an actual increase in cervical cancer in the United States as more females receive the vaccine and stop taking action that may have proved to be protective. Number 9, there is no evidence that Gardasil is effective in boys at preventing genital warts and anal cancer. Merck's study of human papillomavirus vaccine efficacy in males published in the New England Journal of Medicine states that Gardasil is 89% effective against genital warts and 75% effective against anal cancer. Given the fact that there are approximately 300 annual deaths from anal rectal cancer among men in the United States, one wonders how Merck was able to prove such a huge reduction in such an extraordinarily rare problem. As with the female group, external lesions substituted for actual cancer with no proof that lesions of that type actually lead to cancer at all. Yet Merck's statistics garnering their cancer substitute penile and interepithelial neoplasm listed in their appendix to the article show that in men who did not have the human papillomavirus prior to vaccination, both the vaccinated group and the placebo group had the same number of these types of lesions, making the observed efficacy of Gardasil minus 98%. Hence, no benefit. This is how they play with the numbers if you have not a scientific background and understand it. And for human papillomavirus strain 18 related genital lesions, there was actually more lesions, let me repeat that, more lesions in the vaccinated group than the placebo group. So as in the previous study, Merck's impressive numbers for the efficacy of Gardasil in men can only be attained by excluding 1/4 of the study participants. When everyone is included and all outcomes are assessed, the efficacy drops to 0. And finally, Gardasil is not safe. Since 2006, it has caused 111 deaths in girls who were completely healthy prior to vaccination, and life-altering neurological impairments in tens of thousands of others. Most significantly, Gardasil has been associated with unacceptable numbers of serious and life-altering adverse events following vaccination. Dr. Diane Harper, lead researcher in the Gardasil and Cervarix clinical trials, went on record to say that the rate of serious adverse events associated with Gardasil is greater than the incidence of cervical cancer itself. According to the World Health Organization data, the rate of serious adverse reactions reported to the vaccine adverse reporting system is 250% higher than the current age-adjusted death rate from cervical cancer. 250% more people dying than dying from the cancer? The data show that Gardasil has been associated with 24,184 adverse effects since its debut, and remember, that includes seizures, anaphylaxis, paralysis, transverse myelitis, Lou Gehrig's disease, acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, and osteoclonus myoclonus syndrome, uncontrolled movements of the eyes and back and forth jerking, brachial neuritis, loss of vision, postural tachycardia syndrome, facial palsy, deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, chronic fatigue syndrome, blindness, pancreatitis, speech problems, short-term memory loss, miscarriages, multiple sclerosis, autoimmune disorders, abnormal Pap smears, and even cervical cancer. Yes, you heard me correctly. 41 cases of cervical cancer following vaccination by Gardasil. Now, if you knew this was possible, Why would you ever advocate this? While Merck has not made pregnancy a contraindication for Gardasil vaccination, recent data released by the Federal Reporting System reveal that Gardasil is by far the most dangerous vaccine to receive while pregnant, having caused more than 1,300 adverse reactions in its five-year existence compared to the next most dangerous vaccine frequently given to pregnant women, the flu vaccine, which caused 200 adverse reactions over the past 20 years. Gardasil vaccination while pregnant has also been associated both with frequent miscarriages and a high rate of birth defects. But most tragically, as of May of this year, the death toll from Gardasil is now 111. It is not possible to know exactly how many children have been injured or died from Gardasil vaccine because the reporting system is voluntary and estimates are as few as 5% of adverse events are ever actually reported. Indeed, to give just one current example, the Swiss pharmaceutical giant Roche is being investigated after a routine inspection found that it had failed to properly assess 80,000 cases of possible adverse drug reactions, including 15,161 deaths. Do you think that if someone causes 15,000 deaths, that would be a priority for investigation? Evidently not. The efforts of Merck, GlaxoSmithKline, Alec, the CDC, the FDA, and the rest of the medical establishment to force our sons and daughters to be vaccinated against human papillomavirus will not stop. We have to be vigilant against the stealth menace if we want to protect our children against what clearly is a form of medical fascism and preserve our right to make decisions for ourselves and our children free of government interference. We applaud Governor Haley's veto, the covert mandate of Gardasil in South Carolina, but the fight is far from over. It is up to us to do our homework, to tell our representatives in no uncertain terms why we will not agree to risking our children's lives in this greatest of public health experiments that stands to benefit only the drug companies and their supporters. End quote. All fully referenced, all fully footnoted. This is over the 300th original investigative report done on this network. And today's report is now posted, and you can obtain a copy of it, and hopefully you will, and pass it on. It's time the public understood. This was done by Dr. Nancy Ashley and myself, and it's there free for you. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone? I'm Gary Nall. First and foremost, I want to thank the tens of thousands of people in this audience who flooded their senators yesterday, asking them to vote yes to support independent senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, labeled genetically engineered food. How simple is that? 95% of the American population want their food labeled if it's genetically engineered so they can choose to either purchase it or not. But every single thing that would have been pro-consumer and pro-health was given over to Monsanto. Every single one of those, the lobbyist, Alec, they won, the American consumer lost. For now, that's a setback. I will double down on these efforts on upcoming programs, sharing the best science on why we should be concerned about genetically engineered food versus locally grown organic food. So it is not over, just a setback. Let us say hello to my guest who is standing by from Los Angeles, California. She is Dr. Barbara Natterson Horowitz. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, she is the attending cardiologist at the University of California, Los Angeles Medical Center, a professor at UCLA's Division of Cardiology and director of the school's Cardiac Imaging Center. She's also a trained psychiatrist and served as a chief resident at UCLA's Neuropsychiatric Institute, specializes in the relationship between psychological states and heart disease. She is also a member of the Los Angeles Zoo's Medical Advisory Board and is the founder of Zubiquity Research Center. She's also the co-author of a recently fascinating book, Zubiquity, What Animals Can Teach Us About Health and the Science of Healing. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, it's great to be here.
You and your colleague, Catherine Bowers, coined the term zubiquity to identify the correlation between human health and disease with that of other animal species. Perhaps because our hierarchical nature of thinking about the superiority of humans over other life forms, we have unjustly created disconnect based upon a false mythology that what happens to animals cannot happen to us, and therefore there's no reason to investigate animal health or behavior and disease as contributing anything worthwhile about our own medical problems. So please expand upon this and define zubiquity and give us some sense of what this new modality of science hopes to contribute to how we prevent disease.
Well, first of all, I don't think I could have described what we're trying to do better than what you've just said. Yes, I've been a human doctor for a couple of decades, and I'd never really given much thought to the diseases and health concerns of animals in their natural settings. I just sort of thought, well, you know, in the wild, I guess animals, you know, they just die of predation, and I just hadn't expanded that. So when I had this opportunity several years ago to start working a little with the veterinarians at the Los Angeles Zoo, doing some of their cardiac imaging, I started learning from veterinarians that they are taking care of the same kinds of problems in their patients that I was seeing in mine. So Catherine Bowers, a science writer, and I got together and we thought, well, let's really explore human medical problems through the lens of veterinary medicine and wildlife biology and evolutionary biology. And so we thought we'd coin a term for this new pursuit, zubiquity, zo from Greek for animal, and ubiquity, Latin for everywhere.
Great. Now, we rarely ever associate cancer among animals in the wild, although we've come to recognize that animals in deep developed cancer when exposed to toxic chemicals and suffer from horrendous birth defects, such as humans, when exposed to high levels of pollutants. But can we learn about cancer when developed in different animal species in the wild where there's no strong exposure to dangerous chemicals or nuclear radiation? For example, dinosaurs with cancer or brain tumors. Can you enlighten us on that, please?
Right. So that's a great question. Of course, we humans do lots of things to increase our risk of disease. Cancer is a great example. Heart disease, too. I mean, I've spent my life taking care of people who've smoked and eaten and drank their ways to, you know, bypass surgery and liver transplants. But having said that, even if you stripped away all of our bad human habits and the many things that we've done to our environment to increase our risk of disease, you would still have the reality of DNA that needs to replicate, of mutation, and of disease, including cancer. So we learned, for example, that yes, many kinds of animals do get cancer from our companion animals. Veterinarians take care of these patients, you know, a cocker spaniel with breast cancer. Actually, the neuroendocrine tumor that took the life of Steve Jobs not long ago is also found in German Shepherds and some Irish Setters and other dog breeds. So yes, cancer happens in companion animals, but it also happens in wild animals. There are populations that have probably developed cancer through exposures. There was a group of beluga whales in whom breast cancer and colon cancer was found back in the 80s. This was off of northeastern Canada, and a comparable situation for the humans living nearby was found with breast cancers emerging. And, of course, in that case, there was an aluminum smelting facility that had affected probably at least those two species, ours and the whales, and undoubtedly many others that we don't know about. But even going beyond that case, cancer has been found in kangaroos and llamas, and pretty much any mammal that has breasts can get breast cancer. What was really interesting to us, though, was not that cancer is not unique to humans, that it's species spanning, but that it's not unique to our contemporary times. The fossil record indicates, as you mentioned, that there was evidence of some cancer in the bones of dinosaurs. And that opens up a really interesting notion that our environment acts on our genes, and even at a time when there were not man-made effects, the environment can be full of mutagens, and we go into that a little in our book.
Good. Well, we just know, for example, that when a lion in the wild will live anywhere from 8 to 12 years in captivity where they're drinking clean water and have regular food, they can live 25 years, almost doubling the lifespan. And that's true of several other species. You don't realize until you think about what in the environment could be polluting. And that gets into bacteria and parasites that we don't think about, and viruses. So I'd like to go there for a moment, because look at all the horrendous things that we are now finding out about the role of certain deadly bacteria and other microbes and organisms in human health and disease. We discovered the beneficial organisms can keep us healthy, whereas an increase in other pathogenic organisms can contribute to a large variety of diseases. Mm-hmm. So this is also true for different animals.
Absolutely.
So talk about that.
Yeah, so we have a chapter on obesity. And by the way, what we did was simply ask a basic question, do animals get, and I just went down the line of the kinds of problems I saw in my patients, do they get heart attacks? Do they seek out substances? Do they get cancer? And so on and so forth. One of the questions we asked was, do animals get fat? And, of course, we know that our companion animals do. About 40% of our dogs and cats are getting fatter. Believe it or not, there's something called the Catkins diet out there for you know, high protein, low carb, and there's liposuction for dogs, all kinds of stuff like that. But looking at the wild animal case, do wild animals ever get fat, and what could some of the effects be? Anyway, that took us on a great and unexpected journey that led us to the possibility that there could be infectious components to obesity. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean, it doesn't mean that someone who's overweight sneezes on you and you're going to gain weight. No, instead, we know that within our bodies, in our intestines, and even in our skin, there are tens of trillions of bacteria and viruses. We call this the microbiome. And what kinds of bacteria are living in our microbiome can play a role in our health, including how much we harvest from the food that we eat, how many calories we harvest. Now, this also is interesting because we know that farmers sometimes use antibiotics to fatten up their livestock. And that may work through altering this microbiome to favor colonies of bacteria that are better harvesters of calories. If these antibiotics find their way into our food supply and water and whatnot, there's, I think, a good question to ask whether some part of our human obesity epidemic could be connected to these antibiotics.
Good. I appreciate that. Thank you. And give us the final area I want to discuss here is, give us your take on what you believe an ideal diet should be for animals, both in captivity and in zoos and also in people's homes. And because when I visit around the world, and I do all the time, I'm finding dogs and cats in Italy in the countryside living 25, 28, even 30 years. Horses that are not fed grain but are fed grass, healthy grass, living 40 years, double the lifespan. So when you see that radical a difference, and yet there's not a big difference in the genetic makeup of a, you know, German Shepherd in the United States, one in Germany, yet the lifespan and the disease rate are different, talk about the role that you see diet playing.
Yeah, that's such a great question. We sort of ask that question, like, what is the ideal? And to be really scientifically, to be sufficiently skeptical to answer it honestly, I would say I don't know the answer to that, because there's so much variability in what the goals are. You know, we have nutritional goals that vary throughout our life cycle. And the same is true of animals. What we can say certainly is that in many species of animals, needing to work for food, foraging, taking time, making it difficult, expending energy in the pursuit of food seems to be important, not just physically, but also psychologically. For example, we learned that when a feed bag is strapped onto a horse and he just eats from the feed bag, a couple of things happen. Number one, he gains weight. Number two, he gets bored and he does some self-destructive kinds of things, or he may do those things. We think there are lessons for human eating, that it's important that we reconnect with the foraging in our lives, whether that's you know, going, having a garden of your own, going to a farmer's market, taking time to prepare foods. The easy access to abundant food is definitely the culprit on the human side for obesity and I think other psychological problems. And we have many examples of animals for whom that's the case as well.
I appreciate that. And just as a little tidbit, having raised animals my entire life and having, I do rescues. I'm a federal and state licensed animal rescue keeper and all kinds and mm-hmm. getting them to healthy. I took in some ring-tailed lemurs back in 1989 that were 5 years old. The normal lifespan is anywhere from 13 to 15 years. Just one of them died 2 weeks ago at 29 years old. The others are still vitally healthy, doubling the lifespan. It's all about what you feed them. They get raw. They don't get cooked. They get organic. They don't get synthetic chemicals. They're a big, gigantic enclosure where they have plenty of room, lots of bonding, human contact. I just think that we have to pay a whole lot more attention to our own health and the animals that we love. Otherwise, they're going to get the diseases that we're giving ourselves.
Yes, it's so true. And that extends as a physician. I really feel I've become a better physician by working with veterinarians and thinking about animals. You know, when I go on rounds with my interns and residents and medical students, I try to bring in the animal case. That hasn't been something that's done. There's been a, unfortunately, a kind of a divide, as you mentioned. But the truth is, veterinarians have all kinds of knowledge, and we have a lot to learn from animals. And what we learn about health should not only help our health, we should turn around and make sure it applies to the health of not only our companion animals, but wildlife that's so precious.
Well, Dr. Horowitz, thank you, and thank you for writing Zoobiquity. What an original idea. Kudos to you for doing something that just broke the door open to a whole new understanding of what animals can teach us about health. The website is Zoobiquity, Zoobiquity.com. My guest is Dr. Barbara Natterson Horowitz. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now let's go over and say hello to Luann Panessi, who's standing by to talk about the issues that you've written her about, and we'll say hello to Luann. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. As always, just amazing information, things that no one really talks about and the other media are not paying attention to. I have an email here from Catherine from Washington, D.C. She says she's been listening to PSW in Washington, D.C. for about 20 years. And since you left, she said, nothing's been the same. She says, now she listens to PRN. The question that she has for you is, she knows that we're in a monetary crisis right now. She wants to know what really caused this financial crisis. At this point, she says, I trust neither Democrats nor Republicans. She says, but I would really like to get to really what the root cause is.
Well, it's not been discussed in the mainstream media, nor by either party, because if they had to be honest about it, it would change our perception. Let me mention we're coming up to the end of our hour or 55 minutes for many of the stations carrying us, and we thank you for having listened in. If you want to continue listening for another 7 minutes, let me give you a phone number. You can call if you're by, let's say, a radio, and you want to continue listening where it goes off the air, or you can listen over the Internet. The phone number you can call is 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066, or progressiveradionetwork.com. Now to answer your question, and I'm going to answer your question by asking you a few questions in the process, all right?
Yes.
Have you been led to believe that it was the subprime housing crisis and people buying homes that they couldn't afford, signing liar loans, and then the banks trunking those together, sending them out, reselling them, cutting and selling because they were AAA rated, but all this was smoke and mirrors? That's pretty much is that the argument we've heard?
Yes.
It's absolutely not true. The real reason we have an economic crisis today is because we have had an economic crisis for the past 12 years. But here's how they disguised it. And this is what you should know. Do you remember me once telling you that I was very concerned that the value of my property in Florida had gone up 500%, and that was not good, A, because the taxes, the property taxes go up with the value of the land, and it was a bubble. And I said, every bubble that goes up will cause two things. First, what happens when a bubble goes up? Let's say your house is worth $100,000 that you bought it at, and now 3 years later you're in a bubble and it's worth $300,000. What do you do with the difference between the money that your original house was valued at, $100,000, and your new value at $300,000? What do you do with that?
Really? I don't know.
You borrow. You take. You think you have an ATM machine. You take that mortgage to a bank and say, hey, what are you going to give me? The banker said, oh, you've got $200,000 here in new equity. We're going to give you $200,000. So you think that you have an ATM machine attached to your front lawn. It was that money in the artificially increased value of property that then caused an artificial bubble in housing construction. After all, let's get all the contractors in, the land speculators. Then let's bring in the Home Depots because they're going to need lumber and tools and concrete. And all the electricians, all the trades and guilds began to get flood into a market because it was a hot market. There was more demand than there was supply, so let's increase the supply. Well, how do we get the supply? We go to the banks. But what if we don't have collateral? Not to worry. Everything is going up. We'll loan you $100 million to buy this whole area. You'll put in 2,000 units. You'll sell these 2,000 units for $200,000 each. We'll get back our money. You'll make money. Everybody's happy. So it created an artificial bubble economy. It was at the fastest economic growth in American history. No one had made as much money in such a short period of time. I knew people in Manhattan that were having a 100% increase in the value of their property per year. So what this meant was that there was suddenly not the normal growth. We had housing construction, 2% of the gross domestic product to our annual demand, or about $300 billion in current economy. $8 trillion in the housing wealth was created in the bubble. That led to a surge in consumption. If you've got extra money, then, hey, get a new car or buy new clothes or go out to restaurants. So what you have, you then spend. So we had, I'm guesstimating, around 80 million Americans borrowing against the bubble equity. And then they then came to a mindset, I'm going to buy stuff. I deserve it. What about saving? Well, saving, look, this is going to go on for a long time. I hear from everyone, and it didn't go on for a long time. It ended. But in the interim, high pricing houses were going up an average of 15 to 20% per year. Their savings were going down from about 12% to minus 2%. So what was happening to this $8 trillion? It was being spent. In fact, it was so huge that the consumption boom was 4% of the gross domestic product per year, or $600 billion per year Americans were spending. But did they own that money? No, it was a repayment of debt, meaning you were when you were given money on your house, you no longer own the house. You had debt. So now the bank or mortgage company owned your house. You got the use of that money, and they got the title of your house. So we didn't pay it back. Instead, we spent. So we had a bubble in non-residential real estate, in the commercial real estate. Everybody thought what they had was of greater value than what it was. And this raised non-residential construction to as high as 1% of the gross domestic product, or $150 billion a year in the United States in just construction industry. So when the crash came, all the equity borrowing stopped. The consumption spending in a consumption bubble economy stopped. Now you add that together, you're taking $1 trillion in annual demand at its peak, 2005-2007, to $1 trillion minus vanishing after that. That is the true story of our crisis. That meant that the only way the politicians in office and others could say we are doing great is because we were living with the illusion that we were doing great. We were not. We all started thinking that we were richer than what we actually were. It was not based upon any sound economic principle. The normal rise in real estate is 1 to 3% a year, not 15 to 20%, and we spent like blind bandits. That's not going to happen again. Most people have learned that lesson. So when you then you say, well, then how are we going to grow? You better start making sure that the small businesses of America end up getting loans. If the small businesses in America get no interest loans, as long as they hire people at living wages in their communities, you will reestablish a new economy and you reestablish a quality of life. Also, we should start asking. We can't demand, but we can ask and shame the major corporations. Start giving all of your employees cost of living increases and let them have salaries and bonuses that are commensurate with a quality of life that they haven't seen now in 30 years. The only people who have gotten really rich in all this are those who control the corporations and the banks and the finance and the debt. The average person, their standard of living has actually the cost of that standard of living has not kept up with their costs. So they're in the hole big time. That's the truth of it. Okay. Thank you, Luann. That's all the time we have. I want to thank all of you for listening in today. Now, today, our next program, you've heard of Kirk Douglas, the iconic American actor. He's going to be on. By the way, Danny Schechter is away filming for 4 weeks, and Carrie Harrison will be on every Friday for the next few weeks to take his place. It's called The Smart Show. So he's interviewing veteran actor and Kirk Douglas today. That should be interesting. And you all have a nice week. I look forward to sharing more with you Monday night at 8 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network on Talkback. Have a nice day.